it. Now we'll go back to the second half of broadcast number 656. It's July the 2nd, 1984. Going back to Mark Rich and the scandal in South Africa, which is horrendous, ripping us off and not paying his taxes here. He pays $50,000 a day, I've mentioned it before, because he refuses to turn over the records in the government tax fraud investigation. He's already paid $17.56 million to the United States government. Well, if there's $440 million plus that he made off of South Africa, he doesn't have to answer this United States for a long time, because maybe the poor South Africans are giving him the money, because this may be the link of the Broiderbank Band and the Nazis and Henry Kissinger and even some of those Nazi Jews in Israel who arm South Africa. They have a vested interest in, no matter what amount, the court in England has this matter, and in the United States District Court, District Judge Leonard B. Sand, he has upheld the $50,000 a day fine for Mark Rich. Now, you know, you have to have some pretty good secrets to keep that one from being in the news, and that's what he's doing. Another story sent to me by a listener, World Watchers from Barron's, June 11th, 1984. Mark Rich and ARCO, their dealings stir a court fight. And it says back in 1979 and 1980, when oil trader Mark Rich was wheeling and dealing at the crest of the boiling international oil market, one of his prime customers was the Atlantic Richfield Company, ARCO. Now, the Richfield Company had been close to Henry Kissinger and William Rogers and Marvin Davis. And here we have again the Richfield Company, ARCO. How many other oil companies are supplying all the fascist countries in the world? And this article in Barron said that something about the company's deals with Mark Rich must have troubled ARCO, because as early as 1981, this is 3 years ago, its lawyers launched an internal investigation of crude oil transactions with Mark Rich. They got suspicious. Now Rich is a fugitive in Switzerland, his current haven from federal criminal charges, tax evasion scams. Isn't that a nice person to be a 50% partner of 20th Century Fox with all the other cast of characters? And I see Henry Kissinger particularly on the board. Oh, yes, and Gerald Ford of the Warren Commission, who's on the board of directors of this group with Mr. Mark Rich and Marvin Davis. So the Richfield Company, I'll do more of that later and update you on the Richfield story. It's very important of the links of Mr. Anderson of Richfield to Henry Kissinger. But Kissinger is this strong Nazi that came from Oberammergau with the top Nazis, hiding himself as a Jewish Nazi. Let's say he's Jewish and he's still working with them. But Kissinger is involved in every dirty deal, every fascist dictatorship, whether it's the murder of Allende, the murder of Bhutto in Pakistan, the narcotics traffic, Klaus Barbie in Bolivia, all over the world, the narcotics from Pakistan, from Southeast Asia during the war we had in Southeast Asia. Henry Kissinger is into oil scams, raising our oil prices, if you see what they are today and can imagine the future, narcotics, oil scams, skimming from countries, money linked to the P2 and Lizzie O'Jelly, with Michael Ledeen and Alexander Haig and that gang. These are crummy people whose names surface all the time in current investigations. So I did want to mention the London Times story and also the Barron's story. They don't mention Henry Kissinger, but he and Gerald Ford and are close to Mark Rich and, I say, Marvin Davis. Now, for the remaining of the time, I want to finish, I won't ever finish the subject, but I want to complete part two of the Korean Airline that I did the week before last, June the 18th, 1984. I don't want to leave it dangling, because there were two stories in the London Times, May the 20th, and one May the 27th, and I wanted to continue on that story because it is so terribly important, and particularly since I wrote the article for Larry Flint on the Korean Airline and the belief that that was a kamikaze affair, because it was meant to go down with Larry Flint on that plane. And I want to follow news stories to see if they support that or if they are against it. I'm reading them all. I'm not skimming it for you. But I do want to go into that story as much as I can in the weeks to come. And as the London Times story said, and I mentioned it, no instant has caused more outrage, and it was an event, this was that quote I had 2 weeks ago, that fitted only too well with the twisted political myths of our time. It reinforced Reagan's claim that the Soviet Union is nothing but an empire of evil. Now, if some of you have that calendar, 1984, with memorable dates on it, June 25th, just last week, in 1968, Look magazine reported, in terms of the future, 1984, that American Airlines, and I'm sure others did it too, but they were onto this in 1968, American Airline computers kept files on their past passengers, not just because you take a plane now and they want to know who you are, but whoever took a plane on that airline and the flight that they traveled and their seat number, the time of day, and the telephone contact for hotel reservations, and they use these files. 10 to 15 different investigators can have access to those files of where people traveled and so forth. Well, I mentioned 2 weeks ago that Korean Airline emanated from New York City, from Kennedy Airport, with the American Airlines, so Larry McDonald was, they knew where he was sitting, who he was traveling with, and so forth. The American airline that was spying back in 1968 and keeping those files for their future computers as well as the current flights, that was the airline, the home base of the Korean airline is the American Airlines in New York City. I also mentioned that Continental Airlines in Los Angeles fixed out the navigational system, the computer work, that was supposed to be foolproof when Larry McDonald's airplane left Anchorage, Alaska for South Korea. June 14, 1984, there's a story from the San Francisco Chronicle. Pilots want a thorough probe of Continental Airlines. The Airline Pilots Union is embroiled in a bitter dispute, and they claim that the Federal Aviation is covering up safety violations, that they are permitting the unsafe operation of the air carrier to continue. Was one of their unsafe operations having the wrong computer information that didn't sync with the VOR radio that didn't go off up in Anchorage, Alaska, when Larry McDonald sailed out in the Wild Blue Yonder? That's one of the stories. There's another story about Continental Airline right after that. This is June 14th. 1 week later, a judge gives them a big victory that they can break up the union of the pilots. Maybe they were so nice to accommodate the disinformation for the Larry McDonald plane. They had to get some reward. I'm just giving a hypothetical or asking you a question. Is it possible? 1 week later, because supposed bankruptcy problems they were having, they ruled out the union, canceled its contract with the pilots union, and told them they didn't need to keep the financial arrangement they had before. I'm sure they have financial problems, and I'm sure that other airlines have too, but I thought it was interesting or coincidental that both American Airlines and Continental were mentioned in context of what can happen in 1984, and also that they're not safe, and the pilots are claiming that they are a danger. Specifically, they mentioned the Continental Airline. The Wall Street Journal, June 19th, has an editorial by Mr. Kravitz, C-R-A-V-I-T-Z. He's the editorial, charge of the editorial of the Wall Street Journal. This is Gordon Kravitz, I-T-Z. And it's about a newspaper in Greece published under the auspices or continuously under Prime Minister Andreas Papandreou. And they suggest, you know, how far leftist this is and his attitude towards NATO. And they cite the examples of how bad the newspapers in Athens by saying that they even published assertions such as the Korean Airlines flight was a deliberate provocation by the CIA to spy on the Soviets, who had the right to shoot it down. And they also published the Poland Solidarity, worked for the CIA and the mafia-backed Vatican, and the Pope's trip to Poland in June 82, this supposed peace meet was unreported in Ethnos. Now, if two things didn't turn out to be true, but the spy plane, it always was obvious to most people, and the fact that the Pope gave, one story was $50 million, later it was $100 million, to Solidarity. You can see that in the book, in God's Name, the activities of Solidarity in the Vatican. So even currently, the editor on the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal has over almost half a page of the newspaper on how terrible the newspapers are in Athens to print these things. And yet the everyday newspapers outside the Wall Street Journal have stories confirming what was printed in Athens just a year ago. Now, the London Times story that I wanted to update, part two, I'll run down quickly some of the points that I don't want to miss when we go on to other subjects next week, because I left that dangling. I do this all the time, and I decided I wasn't going to do this anymore, no matter how important the news is. I'm going to get back to where I left off for at least one more week, because it should fit together, but we had 1 week interim there where I didn't do it. This was the second part of an article by Murray Sale. And the interesting thing, this had nothing to do with the defense magazine that came out about the Korean airline and its spying. This was a private article written for the London Times, a two-part story. And this author goes into great details. And then when he gets the facts, he can't explain them. Then everything becomes hazy and hypothetical. And he has to come up with possibilities. He says first that the doomed airplane passed near Bethel. That was their first stop, where they were to send a routine message to Anchorage. And everything was absolutely all right. It didn't say anything was wrong, even though the plane was off course within 10 minutes after the time it left Alaska. The NABIF is the next reporting point, and I mentioned that to you. You might remember, and we'll pick up with some of these points. This is all but infallible. They were to go over the ocean. It's dangerous from there. It's of utmost importance. They were off course, and at this point, they were not told that they were going into a dangerous area and were not alerted. And the programming, the INS, was programmed before takeoff. It was checked. The waypoints, they're called waypoints, are where they invariably check in. It's compulsory. And there's an amber light that goes on that tells them when they're just about to arrive, 1 minute before the point where they check in, and 2 minutes after. And then Mr. Sale just gives all kinds of confused reasons why the pilot or the co-pilot or the third pilot couldn't see the amber light for, I don't know what, the lighting was bad all of a sudden on this fail-safe system. He said pilots or co-pilots normally handle radio communications, and they estimate the flight time at the waypoints and get this information, and these alert lights tell them along the way what to do. Then he says, suppose that the automatic pilot is coupled, not to the INS, but to some other source of direction. Suppose, this is where he begins, sort of like the probabilities or the supposes, because there's no other way to explain a fail-safe. And he says the alert lights would still come on if the aircraft is abeam of the waypoint, less than 200 miles away. And he claims the lights went on, but they weren't aware or cognizant of seeing them. He said the crew believed that they were crossing the correct point as they went further and further off course. When the lights came on, they followed the common practice and reported themselves at corresponding waypoints. And the last position they referred to was 185 miles off track, and they were misled, but they still kept sailing on. He said the KAL could not have been coupled to the flight plan that was programmed into the three systems, nor could it have been coupled to the radio beam, which we said wasn't working. Now he says the only other possibility, which I mentioned, was that magnetic head guiding them. But he said this is very, very rare, a very rare occurrence, that the failure of these two not coming together, he repeats again, is a rare occurrence. Then he tries to give excuses what happened, and this is where it gets interesting. He gives about four or five excuses. He says the pilot may have forgotten what he was doing. That's one of the excuses, that he may have forgotten about the system, that they weren't connected to each other. Or there might have been a misunderstanding of a kind not unknown in aviation between the captain and his co-pilot. Or he could have been downstairs talking to Larry McDonald, which I mentioned, because he knew in advance that this prominent president of the John Birch Society in Congress was on his airplane. Or he may have greeted his off-duty colleagues, three captains. Now, because whoever was flying the plane was telephonically in touch with Japan until the moment it went into the ocean, they already know that the main pilot evidently wasn't sitting in his chair, because they say he could have been visiting one or he could have been visiting the other. Now, I won't go into the details of how the Soviet Union tests their airplanes, but the important thing is that when they make tests in the Pacific, they normally communicate to Japan, and Japan warns the other civil and commercial airlines, and the American Airlines, not the company American Airlines, but the planes flying over there, that something is happening in that vicinity. They are nice enough to say something is happening in this vicinity, and we were nice enough to go right over it. And this is the important part of the story. He says, when you study the information, they realized that the pilot was talking all the time to Japan, which I mentioned, and he's not concerned. He's very normal. And the Soviet Union said that they were firing cannon bursts and giving them notice of some kind. But it says at the very instant that the co-pilot of KAL-007 had his headphone on and his chart flight was lit up, he was receiving a message from Tokyo at exactly the same time. By an evil coincidence, at the very minute 007 was talking to Tokyo, First Officer Sons, S-O-N-S, not Chung, the main pilot, was still calm and unhurried. Now, that's what I wrote about. I finished that article at the end of October, but Larry didn't publish it until February because there were about 60 footnotes that they wanted to look up to make sure for legal purposes that they wouldn't be sued, because that was pretty far ahead to have an article ready within a month on the problems with that airplane and the possibility of the kamikaze. Now, a smart person into mind control could be talking to that man and telling him what to do, like sail forward and keep going your course no matter what you see. Remember the controller, Candy Jones, how she gets instructions on the telephone and takes whatever they say to do. Even she was told to go down to Paradise Island and jump off a certain place and kill herself. And her husband, Long John Neville, a radio person from New York City, followed her because he was tape recording hypnosis sessions to try to break the control the CIA had over Candy, and he saved her life. But these pilots evidently didn't have those kind of friends helping them at the time. The important thing, as I say, is that this pilot, with all these people on the plane, was talking to Japan, and it says by an evil coincidence, he suspected nothing. He reported his new altitude. He made his last routine call, and the Soviet Union did every effort to attract attention, and the crew were occupied, busy talking to Tokyo. So there is a state of mind where there was no hysteria. And as I mentioned to you before, the 269 passengers are the amount of people mentioned over and over again that the cruel Russians knocked out of the air. They've only listed 200 names of people on the airplane. Now, usually the KL has a crew of 18 people. This time there were 29. There was no explanation why 11 extra. But if you add up the 18 and the 29, you still have 40 names not listed. And I would believe that out of these, there were 69 altogether where there was no name mentioned. And if you take away the crew, you still have 40 not listed. And the one hypothesis I have is that Larry McDonald was with 40 people from our Defense Department and the military who maybe were to pick up information of some kind or experience and knew that the plane would be used in that way. They would be told, you know, that the Russians would never shoot it down and you would get out in time, which they almost did. They were pretty close to turning around after being 365 miles into the Soviet Union, and whammo, they're shot down. And a martyr is made of Larry McDonald. The editorials that are written are already out on the street within 12 or 24 hours. And that same afternoon, Senator Henry Jackson, who, as I say, lobbied for the Boeing airplanes and their contracts, had one press conference and then died of a heart attack. And that story will be going on, but I did want to finish certain points that I didn't have time to mention before. The People's World has an article by Con Hallinan, The Ghost of KAL Flight 007, Reagan's Gambit. And the gist of this is, of course, that the Soviet Union had accused us of having a spy plane, and they go on to say that this is important because Ronald Reagan, if he set this purposely, there would be a lot of implications. You can imagine sending 269 people to their death. He said the Soviets claimed the plane had low-frequency messages throughout the entire flight that it emanated, and these messages had to do with surveillance equipment that could be produced later. There are persistent rumors the Soviets have firm evidence that the flight was engaged in espionage. Now, this article by Hallinan says the persistent rumors that they have firm evidence. This may be the reason why Ronald Reagan's willing to sit down and talk about the Star Wars weapons, and now Richard Nixon says, let's share our Star War exploration, our war exploration, our space exploration with the Soviet Union to make sure we don't have Star Wars. I felt that the Soviet Union brought Nixon to China and to Russia, blackmailing him on the various political assassinations in this country. And it could be, I know Reagan isn't a nice guy, and he certainly likes the weapons contracts, and even if we had a halt in the weapons manufacturing or the deployment of them, he'd probably keep making them just to keep certain companies in business, such as Rockwell and Lockheed and Linton Industries and so forth. They depend upon the contracts of weapons. But if the Soviet Union has firm evidence that this was a spy plane and they're going to use it, they're going to stay silent and then pull the strings in, you know, like you do fishing and bring old Ronald Reagan in. This article from People's World suggests that there is this evidence. Now, there were a lot of denials when the story came out from Great Britain about this being a spy plane that was linked to the Challenger. Of course, the Challenger went up the night before the Korean airline was shot down. It was simultaneous that the shuttle went up that exact time. The Los Angeles Herald has one denial, June the 12th. The U.S. denies a report that the Korean jetliner was testing Soviet radar. The man they used was Peter Russell of the White House, the spokesman. He said most Western experts said they believe the plane strayed accidentally when its navigational systems malfunctioned and that the spacecraft positions were a coincidence. Number one, the systems can't malfunction. It is totally impossible to malfunction unless the human factor wants it because of the three independent navigational systems. It didn't stray accidentally off because they had a lot of warning and circling, and the Soviet Union wanted to bring the plane down like the U-2. If it had spy equipment on it, it would be to their advantage, and it would be to the advantage of the pilot and co-pilots to bring the crew down rather than to be shot in the ocean. I believe it would be to their advantage. Another quotation from that denial is from Lieutenant Colonel Ed Cook, C-O-O-K-E, the spokesman from the Defense Department, that said at the time of the accident, the Department of State and White House already told you there was no U.S. involvement. Well, J. Edgar Hoover told us there was no involvement in the FBI killing John Kennedy, and Alan Dulles said there was no role of the CIA in killing John Kennedy, and Lyndon Johnson said that he wasn't part of the cover-up of killing John Kennedy, and all those three were liars. So the denial is like Richard Nixon saying, I don't know who the people were at the Watergate Hotel. In fact, there's books on the Central Intelligence Agency, and the first part of their training is how to cover a denial. So when they say in 1984 of June, we told you once there isn't any evidence, that doesn't mean the evidence doesn't exist. It just means we told you once, we'll tell you twice, we'll tell you once again. The Houston Post, June 20th, has some more quotations. Jim Oberg, a space engineer, he said that you're just trying to smear the space shuttle, that it's obviously false that the Challenger would be used for that. These stories are planted by the Soviet Union to defame NASA, the great institution that was put together by Wernher von Braun and top Nazis brought to this country. And they said from the Space Center, the basic laws of nature and geography show that the shuttle could not have participated in any scenario that resulted in the KL tragedy. Now, how would we know by geography and nature what the shuttle was doing? They may have a set plan that they're putting on the air. You can call them up, and it may not be that at all. How do we know what the geography is telling you? They're not going to tell you when that thing is launched in one day and it's flying over there at that time what they photographed or didn't photograph. This fellow from the space station, Oberg, said the space shuttle orbits from Florida far to the south of the Soviet Union. However, we are planned soon to launch a shuttle from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California, and that will be sent in polar orbit and would pass directly over the Soviet Union. I don't believe that a space shuttle launched in Florida stays in the southern belt. I'm sorry, that's too much of a lie, and I just don't believe it. I've studied the Warren Commission too many years to believe that crock. Now, the San Francisco Examiner had another former astronaut the head of NASA, now Naval Space Command, lives in Dahlgreen, Virginia, D-A-H-L-G-R-E-N, Virginia. He said, that's preposterous that the Challenger was used. And another fellow from NASA says that's a preposterous story also. He said the space astronauts in the shuttle have taken photographs of the Soviet Union. And 3 months after the KAL, the astronaut on the ninth shuttle photographed the Soviet missile submarine port and fighter base where the Korean jet had flown over when it was shot down. Well, if you can do that 3 months after, you can do it the same night. That is just so much hogwash. And you really, as I say, have to read the commission hearings and the news coverage after every major event to know that they have a set answer, and they blame the Soviets for disinformation. One thing here, we didn't fly over there, and you know we didn't because you know our geography. And the other one say, oh yeah, we went over there 3 months later. We'll add it up together, and I'm sure that the Space Challenger that went up just the day before the Korean airline went down could be used to fly over the area. And I don't believe that this would be published in the Defense Department magazine in Great Britain, a knowledgeable magazine. It's not like putting it in Gung Ho or Soldiers of Fortune. This is a serious magazine published after almost 1 year's research, and that man didn't write it alone. There were the articles in the New York Times. There was other evidence. There are a lot of people investigating this. And to show that it isn't clear-cut, they've now put Seymour Hersh on the case. Now, next week, I'll get back to some more of the important deaths of witnesses. We don't have time because we have 2 minutes here. But I do want to continue some of these questionable deaths, just as I mentioned that Thornwall this evening, the fellow who was given the LSD, who has a recurrent problems. He's well a while, and he's sick a while, and all of a sudden he had an apparent epileptic fit, and he drowned in a pool in California. One article, maybe I have time for one quick one. No, I'll tell you what, I won't do that. I'm going to summarize the KAL because it's too confusing. I have the list of four important, I think they're important deaths in the last 2 weeks, and we may as well go down the line with those and why I think they were possible murders. I keep bringing up the point that in order for Hitler to come into power in 1933, the Weimar Republic had a series of thousands and thousands of deaths of important people in political parties and judges and lawyers and public citizens. Some were communists, some were writers, and people in political office that had to be wiped out in order to have a successful election where the Nazi Party would be elected. And they cleaned out very well any opposition to their party, and I believe that this is what's happening here in the United States, as well as the death squads in South America, Central America. If the same people are doing these things in South and Central America, such as Henry Kissinger and his gang, then why couldn't Gerry Ford with the Warren Commission be part of the death squad cover-up in this country? Silly question, because I know he is. I'll be back with you. This is Mae Brussels, it's KZUM. No, I'm not going to do it so fast. It's KAZU-FM in Pacific Grove, California, and it is Mae Brussels, and I'll be back with you next week.